Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you an hour of news, history, commentary, and information about the African American community. This week I'll have an opinion piece from the Washington Post newspaper which compares and contrasts W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, an article from the Chicago Tribune about the creation of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, a selection from the British music magazine Mojo, and I'll have three readings from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper and its yearly Black History Month series of articles. The title of the article is AJC Black History Month Series Turns 10. This was written by Ernie Suggs and published Saturday, February 1st, 2025. Those who have no record of what their forebears have accomplished lose the inspiration which comes from the teaching of biography and history. Carter G. Woodson. February is my favorite month of the year. And yes, because it is Black History Month. In 1926, at the height of the Harlem Renaissance, the same year Ralph David Abernathy, Miles Davis, and John Coltrane were born, and the same year the first black woman to earn an aviation pilot's license, Bessie Coleman, died, Carter G. Woodson had a brilliant idea. Black colleges had sprung up all across the South, ushering in the new Negro, a generation of black thinkers, artists, and leaders who were changing how they were being viewed in the country. A country that still had former slaves as a living reminder of an institution that was banned just 60 years prior. In February 1926, Woodson, who had founded the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History in 1915, announced the creation of Negro History Week, which would be celebrated the second week of the month to coincide with the birthdays of Frederick Douglass, the Lion of Anacostia, and Abraham Lincoln, the Great Emancipator. The week eventually became a month. Woodson's vision of Black History Month has now become an important part of Americana, celebrating our achievements while painfully retelling how we got here. Today, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution is marking the 10th anniversary of our acclaimed Black History Month series with Atlanta Unveiled, How African Americans Shaped Our City. As we have done the past 9 years, this daily series will also include stories that expand outside of the confines of Atlanta to nationally explore aspects of black life and culture. Throughout the month, you will read a variety of stories about how black architects, black insurance companies, black mayors, and even the Dungeon family built Atlanta. You will read how the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters redefined the black middle class, how Gil Scott Heron redefined poetry, and how Tucker I.A. Alexander is redefining himself. But since we are talking about history, I wanted to step back to 2016 when my hair was blacker and shorter. I was covering black culture for the paper and a year prior created AJC Sepia. At first, it was a Facebook page that curated AJC articles that would be of interest to black audiences. AJC Sepia was a smash and eventually found its way into the paper itself, while establishing a strong online presence. In January 2016, I was dragged into a meeting and asked what I had planned for Black History Month. It would be easy to say the idea of running a story every day of the month was mine, but I would be lying. That idea actually came from Sandra Brown, the paper's senior editor of visuals. She said Atlanta is such an important city in the essence of black culture that it would be easy to have a story every day. Sandra was right, but like most great editors, she didn't volunteer to write any of those stories. She did give me full use of the paper's photographers and video team, but I wrote almost every story that year under the heading 29 Reasons to Celebrate Black History Month. The inaugural story was about Woodson. I wrote half the stories in 2017, but that is when things changed. Subsequently, I started to write fewer articles as my co-workers started noticing. In the 10 years that we have been doing this, Nearly everyone who has been at the paper during this period has touched this series in some way through writing, photography, video, editing, graphics, or research. One of the things I set out to do when we started was to highlight lesser known but equally significant aspects of Black history. So we never had a real story about Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. or even Rosa Parks until I convinced her biographer to pen an essay for us. Instead, we had stories about double consciousness, the talented tenth, the doll test, and tragic mulattoes. We carved George's Mount Rushmore of music, took a forbidden drink of water with Cecil Williams, and watched how A Kiss in 1898 changed cinema. We explored Black trauma, Black health, Black love, Black queerness, and Black resistance. We stepped with the Zetas, sang Moving On Up, and read a letter to My Old Master. We produced more than 300 pieces of original content through articles, photography, videos, mini documentaries, maps, and charts. Like Woodson, who would go on to write his classic, The Miseducation of the Negro, before he died in 1950, we are going to keep pushing. You can follow this year's series as well as access our full Black History Month library at ajc.com/news/AtlantaBlackHistory. And what we are doing now is perhaps more important than it has ever been. In the flurry of President Donald Trump's relentless issuance of executive orders, rumors floated last week that he was canceling Black History Month. I'm not sure that he can do that, but on Wednesday, as federal agencies scrambled to satisfy Trump's disdain for diversity programs, the Pentagon's intelligence agency said that it was pausing observances of Black History Month, Martin Luther King's birthday, and Juneteenth, among other annual cultural events. If you teach the Negro that he has accomplished as much good as any other race, he will aspire to equality and justice without regard to race. Woodson once said, Amen. There are a couple of photographs that go along with this story. One shows the creator of Black History Month, Carter G. Woodson, standing in front of a library. The book is open on his left knee. His hand is upon the open page and he's staring seriously into the camera. The caption reads, Carter G. Woodson announced the creation of Negro History Week in February 1926. The week eventually became a month, and Woodson's vision became an important part of Americana. The next photograph shows a crowd of thousands of people on a street corner in Harlem, New York. There's an early Model T-style car with the steering wheel on where we would assume the passenger would be. There's one sign that says, The New Negro Has No Fear. The caption reads, A parade by the Universal Negro Improvement Association works its way through Harlem in 1920. It was during the period of the Harlem Renaissance that the vision for Black History Month was born. That was the story. AJC Black History Month series turns 10. It was written by Ernie Suggs and published February 1st, 2025, in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. My next reading is titled, Porter's Union Helped Shape Black Middle Class. It was written by Ernie Suggs and published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper on February 3rd, 2025. The subtitle to the story is, Brotherhood Brought Dignity, Better Wages, Leaders of the Civil Rights Movement. Sometimes dignity can come with something as simple as a name tag. In 1925, dignity came for the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters when the organization got a charter from the American Federation of Labor. The men were issued name tags. Since the Pullman Company began employing black men, many former slaves, as porters to wait on passengers in 1867, they were simply called George, as a derogatory acknowledgement that they were owned by the company's founder, George Pullman. But that changed when the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters became the first labor organization led by African Americans. When the union started, it gave the porters more powers over their lives. Higher pay, more reasonable working conditions and nameplates, said Larry Tai, author of Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class. When they got their own name tags, that gave them a sense of pride and dignity. They could point to the nameplate and say, "This is my name." This year marks the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters by labor organizer and civil rights activist A. Philip Randolph. They were earning more money than any black men in that era, with the possible exception of postal workers. They were seeing the country in a way that black men didn't have a chance to do, Tai said. And they were listening to what their white passengers, who were the leading figures in commerce, science, and the arts, were saying. They were reading newspapers and books that they left behind. Between its founding and eventual demise in 1968, as the lure of rail travel had given way to the automobile and air travel, porters came back to their communities with stories, influence, money, and ideas about how the country could work. In 1867, just 2 years after the Civil War, Pullman, a Chicago business owner, began hiring black men to serve white passengers in his company's luxury railroad sleeping cars. Pullman's strategy was simple. In order to convince people that they were getting an upper-class experience and to spend more money, he figured that former slaves would know best how to cater to their every whim. He was looking for people who had been trained to be the perfect servant, and they knew they would come cheap, so he paid them next to nothing, Tai said. Pullman recruited men to lug baggage, shine shoes, set up and clean sleeping berths, and serve passengers. In the early 1900s, when other companies were not hiring African Americans, the Pullman Company became the largest single employer of black men in the country. Porters made up about 44% of the Pullman Company's rail operations workforce. For many in the black community, with its steady stream of income, being a Pullman porter was one of the most coveted jobs in America. But they were underpaid and overworked, often toiling 400 hours a month on a set salary, all while enduring a constant stream of racism. Frustrated that the American Railway Union had refused to accept black railway workers, which by 1925 had swelled to more than 10,000 porters, Randolph led a push to form the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. The Brotherhood's motto was, "Fight or be slaves." In 1937, after years of resistance, the Pullman Company signed a contract with the union, which led to higher salaries, better job security, and increased protection for workers' rights through grievance procedures. As important as is this lucrative contract as a labor victory to the Pullman porters, it is even more important to the Negro race as a whole. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People's Crisis magazine wrote at the time, "From the point of view of the Negro's uphill climb for respect, recognition, and influence in economic advance." Members of the Brotherhood of Porters, including Randolph, would go on to play key roles in the civil rights movement, helping to influence public policy in the South and nationally. One of the key early figures of the Montgomery bus boycott was Edgar Daniel E.D. Nixon, who served as president of the local chapter of both the NAACP and Montgomery, Alabama branch of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. Nixon was spending so much time out on the train, so he needed help. But he saw that there was a young, smart minister in the town named Martin King, Tai said. So he deputized him to take over the Montgomery bus boycott. King, who was the pastor of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, became the face of the local movement. They were a big deal, but a forgotten deal in the history of black America, Tai said of the union. They were forgotten because we only have room for a limited number of facts. If you mention civil rights, you mention Martin Luther King, but not E.D. Nixon, who recruited him, nor A. Philip Randolph. If King was the father of civil rights in America, Randolph was the grandfather. Randolph, who led the union for more than four decades, eventually became a mentor to King. In 1963, when King delivered his I Have a Dream speech, it was at the March on Washington, which was crafted and organized by Randolph. At its height, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters had a membership of more than 18,000 passenger railway workers across Canada, Mexico, and the United States. Ty estimates that when his book came out in 2004, there were about 20 living Pullman porters. Now there are none. They all played a significant role, Ty said, not just in the development of Black America, but in the development of America. There are some photographs that go along with this story. One shows a meeting in the White House with President Eisenhower. There are six men in the picture. The caption reads, President Dwight Eisenhower discussed civil rights issues with Black leaders in 1958. From left, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., E. Eric Morrill, President Eisenhower, A. Philip Randolph, Attorney General William Rogers, and Roy Wilkins. There is another photograph that shows a receiving line in Canada. In the background, there are the flags of the United Kingdom and also of all the provinces of Canada. Then to the right, there is a receiving line in which there are sleeping car porters who are meeting Princess Elizabeth. The caption reads, Princess Elizabeth thanks Pullman porter Noel Mapp of Montreal as other porters from the Royal Train form a line in Canada in 1951. That was the article titled, Porter's Union Helped Shape Black Middle Class. It was written by Ernie Suggs and published February 3, 2025 in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. My next reading is titled, A Southside Gathering of Black Intellectuals Set the Stage for Black History Month. This was written by Ron Grossman and was published in the Chicago Tribune newspaper on February 2, 2025. The seeds of Black History Month were sown more than 100 years ago in the Southside YMCA at 3763 South Wabash Avenue, Chicago. Carter G. Woodson, a University of Chicago alum, was staying in a room at the Colored YMCA, as it was designated, while manning a booth at the exposition of 50 years of Negro progress in the nearby Chicago Coliseum. It marked the 50th anniversary of the 13th Amendment ending slavery, and Woodson was selling posters celebrating Black heroes and books about Black history. He also hoped to find a publisher for the doctoral dissertation he'd written at Harvard University, despite the racist attitudes of some faculty members, including one who argued that there was no Black history in America, according to Woodson's book, The Miseducation of the Negro. Professor Edward Channing dismissed the importance of the Boston Massacre in 1770, considered a turning point in American history, because one of those who was killed, Crispus Attucks, was Black. Channing spoke of Crispus Attucks and his companions as idlers who happened to be among those who were throwing missiles at British soldiers stationed in Boston, Woodson recalled in his book. Woodson would say it took him 20 years to recover from Harvard. The process began at the Southside YMCA. It was a gathering place for Black intellectuals and professionals, and Woodson's gift for gab enabled him to keep pace with them. Their accomplishments belied the racism of his professors. Once on a ride to a college where he was to speak, Woodson talked so interestingly, a professor said, that when we arrived at the college, the cab driver said he would park the cab if he were permitted to come inside the classroom and hear Dr. Woodson speak. So on September 9, 1915, Woodson confidently invited four African-American notables to a meeting at the YMCA. There he persuaded a doctor at Provident Hospital, the head of the Colored Y, and the orator of his Harvard graduating class, his assistant who had a master's degree from Yale, and a lawyer who, like Woodson, taught high school in Washington to join him in founding the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History. It published the Journal of Negro History. it had a section titled Undistinguished Negroes, Accounts of Workaday Folk. Today that approach is known as history from the bottom up. Back then, white scholars saw history through the eyes of society's nabobs, kings, and presidents. In 1926, Whitson proclaimed a Negro History Week in a pamphlet he sent to schools, colleges, and community groups. The states of Delaware, North Carolina, and West Virginia urged teachers to support Whitson's project. So too did the cities of Baltimore and the District of Columbia, headmasters of private schools and university presidents. Beginning in 1976, successive American presidents have proclaimed February as Black History Month. Fittingly, the Chicago Public Library's repository for the Gold Nuggets of Black History is named for its godfather, Whitson Regional Library at 9525 South Halsted Street. Carter Whitson was born in 1875 in Buckingham County, Virginia. His mother and father were enslaved before the Civil War. Enslaved people generally bore the name of their enslavers. Carter Whitson's last name indicates a forebear was John Whitson, an English immigrant at the dawn of America and an owner of enslaved Africans. During the Civil War, Whitson's grandfather fled to a Union detachment and saw action in its final battles. After the war, he encouraged Carter Whitson to go to school. Blacks could vote, and he needed his grandson to read him newspaper accounts of candidates for office. He was loath to vote for an ex-Confederate. Some of Whitson's relatives moved to Kentucky, where he enrolled in Berea College. The school was dedicated to lifting students out of poverty and considered books the stepping stones. Carter Whitson had just realized the potential of that idea when Kentucky outlawed interracial classrooms. Whitson transferred to the University of Chicago, determined to become a teacher for the sake of his fellow African Americans. From hearing his grandfather's and parents' stories, he knew that the idea of black people not having a history was pure bunk. But he lacked a resource white historians had: conferences where he could share their preliminary findings. Whitson was a dues-paying member of the American Historical Association, but he and other black historians often couldn't even attend the group's annual conventions because of segregation. The solution was the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, later the Study of African American Life and History. Keeping the organization afloat was a struggle. The Chicago philanthropist Julius Rosenwald, famed for his generous aid to blacks, limited his contribution to $100 annually. He explained he wasn't interested in the printer's ink method of helping the Negro. Whitson borrowed $400 against his life insurance policy to have the first issue printed. He was determined to publish studies of the miseducation of the Negro, as he titled an anthology of his ideas. In 1919, Whitson joined the history faculty at Howard University, but neither Howard nor any other black colleges offered classes in black culture. Black students were taught Europeans' achievements, but nothing about those of African Americans. Whitson said the result was similar to enslaved people bearing their masters' names. Educated Negroes were conditioned to think they were powerless to change their servile condition. They passed that psychological handicap on to the students they taught in black public schools. Whitson and Howard weren't a match made in heaven. He was contemptuous of indifferent students and told them so bluntly. The student magazine satirized him in its description of an ideal faculty. Just imagine Dean Carter Whitson without his sarcasm. A break with its white president was precipitated when a Republican senator demanded that the book 76 Questions on the Bolsheviks and the Soviets be removed from Howard's library. The university president wanted to comply, but Whitson refused, saying academic freedom meant not giving a member of Congress the power of censorship. From then on, it was a race to see if Whitson would resign or be fired, saying he was too untrusting of white administrators who were unfit to administrate black colleges. Whitson left Howard and took a position at West Virginia Collegiate Institute, another historically black college, which is now called West Virginia State University. That position also proved short-lived. Freed of teaching and faculty infighting, Whitson campaigned endlessly for black history. He gave myriad lectures to black groups like Boston's League for Women and Community Service and Philadelphia's Alpha Phi Alpha chapter's annual Go to High School, Go to College campaign. He organized Black History parades and produced materials for Black History clubs. Virtually out of funds in 1925, he asked Franz Boas, a noted anthropologist, to endorse his appeals for funding. Boas did so while noting, "It is rather difficult to cooperate with him, but his work is credible." And so, beginning this week, students in the city and suburbs alike will observe Black History Month. By doing so, they will fulfill a dream that the son of former slaves had in Chicago's colored YMCA 110 years ago. That was the article, "A Southside Gathering of Black Intellectuals Set the Stage for Black History Month." This was written by Ron Grossman and published in the Chicago Tribune newspaper on February 2, 2025. My next reading is an opinion piece from the Washington Post newspaper. The title is, "These Giants of Black History Were Rivals, But Time Knits Them Together." It was written by Theodore R. Johnson and published February 28, 2024. In 1895 in Atlanta, the Cotton States and International Exposition put a spotlight on the New South to showcase an American future. People from all over attended this World's Fair, where the latest innovations in textiles and agriculture were on exhibit, along with electrical appliances, imported whiskeys, and more. Societal improvements were on display, too. An editorial in Scientific American declared the event would be the day of reconciliation between the whites and the Negroes. But the New South was up to its old tricks. States were sidestepping the post-Civil War constitutional amendments mandating equal justice and barring racial discrimination in voting. So at the opening ceremony, esteemed educator Booker T. Washington laid out his vision for how black people could resist the backsliding, telling the rapt audience, "No race that has anything to contribute to the markets of the world is long in any degree ostracized. Honest work and economic self-sufficiency were the way forward. Social equality could wait." This was the Atlanta Compromise. Renowned sociologist and author W.E.B. Du Bois had other ideas, believing that political action and enforcement of civil rights protections would make the South and the nation anew. He suggested this work be led by a talented tenth, a select few college-educated men who would embody the ideals of the community, directing its thoughts and heading its social movements. Equality would not wait. The exceptional black men would see to that. The Washington-Du Bois debate captures the essence of a nation in a way that is particularly American and particularly black. It is a shared history. Washington chastised Du Bois' approach as elitist, scoffing that it's better to earn a dollar in a factory then spend a dollar in an opera house. Du Bois responded that a people not educated in the systems of democracy and justice would never get much of either, no matter how much they sweat. How can black people best find the America that others enjoy? It was a question to the people as much as to a country. And not just a question. This debate offers a peek into the nation's tendencies, at its nature and character. A core tension exists in the United States between an economic prosperity in which everyone is paid their fair share and a democracy where everyone has a voice. We are a people who can't agree on which is more important, or where we should put more energy, or who's allowed to participate and how. There's always compromise. Sometimes it's the only way. But someone must tell the others that they don't get to benefit this time, that they don't get democracy just yet. The Atlanta Expo offered a snapshot of a new South where economic growth might make space for everyone, even for people democracy excluded. Prosperity, the editorial declared, means that political, economic, and racial problems have been solved. But this was a fool's goal to Du Bois. Better that the talented tenth venture out from the black community as collegiate emissaries, advocating in the halls of power and returning with knowledge and rights. A people so equipped could succeed in any market they choose. They'll just need to make a living until the heroes come home, if they return at all. This was more than an intellectual exercise. Exploitative sharecropping arrangements made black prosperity impossibly difficult at the time, even in a thriving economy. Poll taxes and literacy tests pried away the vote earned in the Civil War and more than 1 million American casualties. Violence and the threat of it were ever present. Some of the talented 10th ventured off and were lynched. Some of Washington's earnest laborers were, too. So the New South modeled at the Expo failed to materialize. The Old South refused to die, finding redemption instead. Over the next 70 years, transformational legislation, executive action, and judicial rulings arrived. The history of those decades suggests that a people denied their equal rights will not give up until they have them. And if black history has taught the United States nothing else, it's that equality gets tired of waiting. The Civil Rights Movement brought the long-overdue national correction, a prized win belonging in equal measure to Washington's workers and Du Bois' tenthers. A win for the country as much as for the people. The men never reconciled their views, but the goal of making the United States truer to its ideals was always shared. Washington spent his later years maneuvering with the political elite to direct resources to the Black South. Du Bois abandoned the talented 10th idea, coming to believe that democratic equality was nearly impossible because the nation's economic practices often leave the worker behind, especially a black one. Atlanta today proves the value of their disparate approaches, as well as the inefficiency of each. It has become a place where it's nothing to see black people earn with their hands in the day and enjoy the theater by night. The same is true elsewhere, in the South and in the United States, but they still must work harder for prosperity and fight for more inclusion. Washington finished his exposition speech with optimism that America could address its race problem and make justice accessible to all. This, coupled with our material prosperity, he vowed, will bring into our beloved South a new heaven and a new earth. It's a dream particularly American and particularly black, and unavailable for compromise. That was the opinion piece written by Theodore R. Johnson titled, "These Giants of Black History Were Rivals, But Time Knits Them Together." This was published February 28, 2024, in the Washington Post newspaper. My next reading is an article put out by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper as part of his Black History Month series of news stories. The title is "Black Architects Helped Build City." It was written by Nedra Roan and published February 2, 2025. On Sunday in May 1917, on the first day of services at the newly built First African Methodist Episcopal Church in Athens, Georgia, the congregation celebrated with a processional and mortgage burning. They had raised more than $7,000 to build the brick Victorian-style structure, which included a bell tower, hammerbeam roof, and stained glass windows. The architect, Makins Lewis H. Pursley, a 1914 graduate of Carnegie Institute of Technology, now known as Carnegie Mellon University, was off serving in World War I. Like most trained black architects in the early 1900s, Pursley's career would be delayed. Not by the war, but by discriminatory practices that prevented him from earning a professional license for nearly a decade. Pursley taught mechanical drawing at Tuskegee University until 1920, when he became the first black architect registered in Georgia. His work includes landmarks such as the Colored Masonic Temple in Birmingham, Alabama, and the Campbell Church Chapel in Americus, Georgia. There's even a street in Macon with his surname. But like so many black architects, much of Pursley's story is untold. Anyone who has spent time at Atlanta Landmarks has likely observed, utilized, and enjoyed the work of Atlanta's black architects. It's a long list that includes Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport, Centennial Olympic Park, Zoo Atlanta, the Atlanta Botanical Garden, Ebenezer Baptist Church, Martin Luther King Jr. National Historic Park and Birth Home, the Five Points in Midtown MARTA stations, the Buckhead Library, the Fulton County Courthouse, Underground Atlanta, and the campuses of Spelman and Morehouse Colleges. But these achievements were hard won. The lack of opportunity and diversity in the field, combined with inadequate preservation efforts, have left black architects and architecture in near constant peril. One effort to preserve historic structures designed by black architects came in 2022, when the Getty Foundation committed $3.1 million to the Conserving Black Modernism Initiative. Some of that money went to protect Dansby, Brawley, and Wheeler Halls at Morehouse College, all designed by Atlanta architect Leon Allain. Allain, along with Edward Charles Miller, considered to be Atlanta's first registered black architect, were among the forefathers of black architecture. The two met at Tuskegee, where Miller was a professor and Allain was a student, and together they formed Miller and Allain Architects in 1959. Miller had already designed notable buildings in Atlanta, including the Interdenominational Theological Center, Ebenezer Baptist Church, and many homes in the Collier Heights neighborhood, before partnering with Allain. Their joint portfolio consisted primarily of historically black colleges and universities. Allain went on to form his own firm, Allain & Associates, in 1967, and had a breakout moment when he developed joint ventures with other black architects to propose work on larger projects, such as the Georgia Dome and Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport. The airport, then as now, was a catalyst for industry in Atlanta, said Garfield Pert, director of operations at Moody Nolan, one of the country's largest black-owned architecture firms with offices in 12 cities. It is a $10 billion program that still continues, he said. It is part of the city of Atlanta, so diversity was heavily encouraged. Those once-in-a-lifetime projects in Atlanta, the airport, the 1996 Olympics, and later Mercedes-Benz Stadium, could help propel an architect to a successful career. Allain eventually began working on projects across the state, and he earned a pilot's license to fly between job sites. In 1999, he sold his practice, but his legacy lives on through a scholarship fund designed to benefit future black architects at his alma mater. Another black pioneer in the field, South Carolina native J.W. Robinson, graduated from Hampton University in 1949 with a degree in architecture, but he was denied a license because of discrimination. Instead, he worked as a school teacher for 15 years at Booker T. Washington High School. Without a license, his design work was limited to residential housing, and he developed a passion for creating homes that would reshape black communities impacted by segregation. In the 1950s, Collier Heights was a bustling neighborhood where notable black residents moved, and many of the homes there were designed by Miller and Robinson. Built in 1956, Robinson's famous Alphabet Ranch House, a style of home designed to replicate the shape of a letter, is often referenced as an example of unique mid-century housing styles in Collier Heights. Shaped like the letter O, the house was designed for the band director at the school where Robinson taught. By the 1970s, Robinson had earned his license and started his own firm. As the first black architect in the state to be named a fellow of the American Institute of Architects, an honor given to those who have made outstanding contributions to the field, Robinson's work reflected his commitment to preserving the cultural and architectural history of black Atlanta. Robinson's legacy was continued by his sons, Joseph W. Robinson, Jr., and Jeffrey L. Robinson, who also became an architect. Robinson Sr. and Jeffrey have died, but in 2015, Jeffrey told Creative Loafing, "African Americans have played and will continue to play a vital role in shaping the city's architectural and cultural history. The last decade has shown that most people don't understand the significance of our historic buildings. That significance had an impact in Collier Heights, a neighborhood rich in black architecture." William Stanley found his calling when his family moved to the neighborhood in the 1950s. Stanley enjoyed watching the construction of churches and homes in the community. He applied to Georgia Tech's School of Architecture, knowing he would have to prove himself at a school that had yet to graduate a black student. He became the first one when he earned his degree in 1972. At Tech, Stanley met his future wife, Ivanue, capital I-V-E-N-U-E, the first black woman to earn a degree in architecture from the school. They married in 1978 and launched a firm. Small projects kept them afloat in the early days as they both worked other jobs. It took almost 15 years before larger projects began flowing their way in the early 1990s, including the renovation and expansion of Grady Memorial Hospital and the Olympic Aquatic Center at Georgia Tech. Among their most well-known designs is the Horizon Sanctuary of Ebenezer Baptist Church, a 1,600-seat sanctuary inspired by an African tribal meeting house. Its Afrocentric design elements include a thatch-style copper roof that will Pantene to green and an obelisk bell tower inspired by the obelisk or stele of Axum in Ethiopia. Architecture should be a celebration, Stanley said, and their firm is guided by its desire to work with clients who understand the firm's ethos. It has been a labor of love, and Atlanta was the right city at the right time, and Ivanue was the right partner, he said. Now in their 70s, the Stanleys are still hard at work, but in an atmosphere very different from when they began almost 50 years ago. Opportunities for black architects in Atlanta have been shrinking for decades, a casualty of a shifting political and business climate that long ago lost its champion, Maynard Jackson. The boom years for black architects in Atlanta began when Maynard Jackson was elected as the city's first black mayor from 1974 to 1982, and again in 1990. Jackson was intentional about bringing black architects to the table on major city projects. Perhaps inspired by Whitney M. Young Jr.'s 1968 speech at the American Institute of Architecture National Convention, calling for diversity in the profession, Jackson issued a call to newly minted ranks of black architects. His economy integration policies created unprecedented opportunities for black people in Atlanta by mandating that a percentage of city and airport contracts go to minority businesses. From 1974 to 1979, the percentage of city business that went to minority firms jumped from 0.5% to 38%. For Oscar Harris, that was enough incentive to leave Parsons Brinckerhoff, where he worked on conceptual designs and project management for MARTA, to strike out on his own. The Pittsburgh native and graduate of Pennsylvania's Lincoln University had attended architecture school at Howard University before transferring to Carnegie Mellon. In 1973, based on the strength of his thesis on transit, Parsons Brinckerhoff invited him to Atlanta. With a loan from his brother and the support of his wife Sylvia, in 1977 he opened the Atlanta outpost of Turner Associates, an unair-conditioned 500-square-foot office on Peachtree Street. He had a new home, a young family, and no business. I was scared, but I had the credentials and I was committed to my own spirit, Harris said when he talked at his home in southwest Atlanta. He described that moment as jumping off a cliff and hearing nothing but air. I wanted to be in charge of what I was doing. I wanted to own what I do. I wanted to be selected for major iconic public structures, he said. His first job was designing a water treatment plant, but Harris did it with no hesitation. In those early years, he drove to work at 4 a.m., returned home at 5 p.m., then spent the hours between 7 and 9 p.m. developing new business. Harris has left an extensive imprint on downtown Atlanta with projects that include Underground Atlanta, the iconic Centennial Olympic Park Light Towers, the Atlanta Public Schools Administration Building, and the Sam Nunn Atlanta Federal Center. Designed for the Fulton County Government Center was inspired by a trip to South Africa, where Harris had observed a government center with walls inside of walls. He would use that design concept on the south side of the Atlanta building. Unique architectural design is like bending a note in jazz, Harris explained as we sat in his home office surrounded by his abstract expressionist paintings. When he closed his firm in 2010, Harris turned to painting, a path more creative and less competitive than architecture. In his 2013 memoir, Oscar, The Memoir of a Master Architect, Harris reflected on his career, noting that in the years since the 1996 Olympics, with a decline in diversity initiatives, black architects began to see public sector opportunities dry up. Atlanta has not continued to build that foundation of coming together and being totally inclusive, Harris wrote. This approach will not be good for Atlanta in the long haul. These days, Harris spends his time painting, his brushstrokes accompanied by the music of John Coltrane or Miles Davis. Sometimes he shows his artwork in solo exhibits. Although he remains a licensed architect, his engagement with the field is mostly mentoring young students through Spike Studio, a nonprofit that encourages minority students to pursue careers in architecture. Today, black architects compose 2% of architects in the country, said Pert of Moody Nolan. In Georgia, there are 230 licensed black architects, according to the National Organization of Minority Architects. Young black architects are rising in the ranks in Atlanta, but black architecture firms struggle to survive beyond a single generation because there aren't enough black architects in the pipeline. The expectation that Cheryl McAfee would take over the family business was clear. She was interested in wildlife and the outdoors, but her father was adamant she study environmental design at Kansas State University. Charles McAfee had an established practice in Kansas before opening an Atlanta office in the 1970s. Cheryl McAfee recalls traveling between Kansas and Georgia while her father worked, excited by everything that was happening in Atlanta. After earning a master's degree in urban design from Harvard University, she began working for a firm in Boston. Her first project was the biggest project in the city, Copley Plaza. She was moving up, particularly after taking on a big project in Jubail, Saudi Arabia. But her dad, fearing she may stray too far from home, made a pitch for her to work with him. McAfee agreed, and in the 1990s she began working on her biggest project yet, designing, constructing, and managing the sports facilities for the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta. It was a magnificent project, but a fight every day, McAfee said. She was reminded regularly of the challenges of being a woman in the profession. Black women make up less than 0.5% of architects in the country. McAfee had recruited a diverse team, but other firms on the project would often question their credentials. When it was time for photographs, they put her team front and center to make sure the project looked diverse. When the project ended, larger firms hired members of her team at salaries 2 to 3 times greater than what she could pay, she said. Working with her sister, McAfee has kept their father's legacy alive and carried the firm forward with new vision. Their projects include the conversion of the Ashby Street Theater, one of Atlanta's first theaters to serve the African American community, into a multi-use business and community center. They are also restoring the Phyllis Wheatley YWCA, which had been closed for over a decade, but will offer health and wellness classes and services for kids when it reopens later this year. I want to leave something that lifts somebody else up, whether it is inclusive of the people who work on the project or the people that will use the space, McAfee said. When you lift up everybody, everybody benefits and you have a better community. That was the article, Black Architects Helped Build City. It was written by Nedra Roan and published February 2, 2025, in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. My next reading is from the British music magazine called Mojo, M-O-J-O. This is from the February 2025 edition, and it's titled, How Great Thou Art, The Stories of Author, Big Boy Crudup, Big Mama Thornton, and More, written by Danny Eccleston. It is a review of the book, Before Elvis, The African-American Musicians Who Made the King, written by Preston Lauterbach. that Elvis Presley's rock revolution was built on raw materials mostly learned from black blues, gospel, and R&B artists will be news to no one. But luckily, that's only the starting point of Preston Lauterbach's illuminating study. In pooling the lives and careers of Presley's key influencers, among them author Big Boy Crudup, whose version of That's All Right began Presley's ascent, and Big Mama Thornton, whose Hound Dog rocket-powered it, he frees them from the files of the ripped-off and victimized, although they were those things too, and affords them their own agency. Crudup, for one, emerges as a prodigious shifter of units in his own right. In 1994, notes Lauterbach, his That's All Right was already such a staple that when 45 RPM disc debuted, RCA reissued it on orange vinyl to hype the format. Neither was it a surprise to learn that the impact of Presley's success on those he channeled was both too little and too late. But the details are sobering. Crudup heard Elvis's version of That's All Right on a jukebox in Franktown, Virginia, and wrote to Lester Melrose, the white controller of his publishing, asking if he'd heard it too. Melrose wrote back saying indeed he had, but failed to mention the royalty checks he'd been receiving on Crudup's behalf. In 1973, after they bought out Melrose, Presley's publishers Hill and Range were approached by Crudup, but they refused to settle. The singer's family would not see a penny until 1975, the year Chapel Music bought Hill and Range, by which time Crudup was dead and one of his sons in jail for robbery. The charge could hardly be more ironic. Mixed fortunes were the lot of other key influences. Guitarist Calvin Newborn, whose pink suit and hip gyrations Elvis had clocked at shows in the early 1950s, hitched to the rising star of his jazz pianist brother Phineas Jr. before being drafted in 1957. His subsequent career included a stint with Sun Ra, but music rarely paid the bills. In the 1960s, dealing heroin was a more reliable occupation. Big Mama Thornton struggled to maintain a living until British and Bay Area blues boomers started singing her praises in the mid to late 1960s. Janis Joplin's version of Thornton's Ball and Chain brought her more satisfaction and financial reward than she ever received via Elvis's Hound Dog. The fiery Thornton was prone to denigrate Presley, saying he refused to perform shows with her. Lauterbach is more circumspect. Presley, he writes, was fastidious in name-checking black artists, although he probably could have done more to advance their careers. The racist statement often attributed to him, "The only thing Negroes can do for me is buy my records and shine my shoes," is impossible to substantiate. For his part, Calvin Newborn, who described Presley hanging out and eating meals with his family, remembered him as a disseminator of black music, not a thief, a cultural integrator, not appropriator. He ate pork chops and gravy sandwiches, Newborn told Lauterbach before his death in 2018. He was a soulful dude. The King was the big fact in author Crudup's career. Junior Parker, whose mystery train Presley had homaged, appears not to have given him much thought. But it didn't remain so. Look beyond That's All Right, perhaps with the help of Bear Family's 5-disc box set, A Music Man Like Nobody Ever Saw, and you'll find over 100 recordings of similar richness and artistry. Vehicles for Crudup's cool tenor and stinging guitar that fascinate beyond any relationship with Presley or the part they may arguably play in white rock story. You could say the same for Thornton, Parker, and the rest. Lauterbach would surely agree that the best way to reclaim or to honor Elvis's antecedents is to listen to them. There's a sidebar to this story that has some more information taken from the book. It's titled, What We've Learned. Bullet point number one. Life was tough for hit-making blues artists. Even in the successful years, Big Mama Thornton made ends meet shining shoes. Author Crudup worked as a fruit picker and liquor store porter. Bullet point two. By the time of Crudup's 1947 version, That's All Right's refrain had been passed down through Blind Lemon Jefferson's Black Snake Moan in the 1920s, in variations by Big Joe Turner and Louis Jordan. The next bullet point reads, Thornton was an enthusiastic, although unpredictable, driver, not helped by her prodigious intake of old granddad bourbon. Charlie Musselwhite remembers her hitting an empty oil drum employed as a road marking. When asked if she should really be driving, she replied, Hell, I meant to hit that can back there. The final bullet point reads, After a consistent, varied, and not unsuccessful career, Junior Parker died in 1971. His gravesite remains unknown. That was the story, How Great Thou Art, the stories of author Big Boy Crudup, Big Mama Thornton, and more, written by Danny Eccleston. It appeared in the February 2025 edition of the British music magazine called Mojo. This story was a review of the book Before Elvis, The African-American Musicians Who Made the King, written by Preston Lauterbach and published by Hatchet. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African-American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.